come true. Susan knew she was no longer his mission. The letter broke her heart. By the end of his third year, Borman ranked near the top of his class. For her part, Susan had enrolled at the University of Pennsylvania's Dental Hygiene School, following in her mother's footsteps. While there, she was offered a contract with the Ford Modeling Agency in New York, which she declined. During quiet moments, Borman wondered if he'd made the mistake of a lifetime by letting her go. In the summer of 1949, Borman was one of a select few cadets chosen to tour post-war Germany. For him, the biggest impression came at the Nazi concentration camp at Dachau. There he saw the firing range and gallows used to execute Jewish prisoners, and the ovens used to cremate them. And he saw families, East German refugees, living in tiny stalls in the barracks, separated from other families only by hanging blankets. These were people who'd chosen to give up everything and flee to the West rather than live under communist rule. The trip sickened and saddened him, and it reinforced his certainty that America was a force for good in the world, a country that stepped up to help suffering people and defend freedom. When Borman returned from Germany, he only missed Susan more. She'd returned to Tucson after earning her degree and was chosen over 71 other contestants as the city's representative at a Mardi Gras festival in Mexico. The local newspaper showed her draped in a silver-blue mink cape and wearing over $1,000 worth of silver and turquoise. In case Borman had forgotten what he'd lost, the newspaper noted that the selection was based on beauty, poise, personality, charm, and intellect. Borman graduated 8th in a class of 670 at West Point. It was a beautiful ceremony, but all he could see were the swarms of girlfriends and fiancés who'd come to shower love on his classmates. His only comfort came from knowing he'd been among those selected for a coveted spot in Air Force flight training, and from driving his parents back to Arizona in the new car he'd purchased, a blue Oldsmobile Rocket 88 stretch coupe with a V8 engine and a bench seat in back. Borman had 60 days leave before reporting for flight training at Perrin Air Force Base in Sherman, Texas. On the first of those days back in Tucson, he called Susan and asked her to dinner. They hadn't had a date in ages, and she still had hurt feelings from their breakup of 3 years ago, but she agreed. He took her to a small Italian restaurant on the outskirts of town. They laughed and talked and connected as if they were still in high school. Even the owner could see their chemistry because he kept feeding the jukebox and pressing the love song buttons. Borman didn't waver this time. He did what he'd been wanting to do for years. He asked Susan to be his wife. There was no talk of the challenges of a military life or the risks he'd be taking as a fighter pilot. There was just the question, "Will you marry me?" And her answer, "I will." A month later, Frank and Susan were married in a Tucson Episcopal church. After honeymooning at the Grand Canyon and in Las Vegas, the Bormans reported to Perrin Air Force Base, then to Williams Air Force Base in Chandler, Arizona. These were fun and adventurous times for the new couple, even if training was risky. Men died from losing control while pushing the limits in these high-performance jets, but it never occurred to Borman that he'd be hurt. Others had survived the training, and he knew he was better than any of them. Susan never complained about the dangers of Frank's job, the hours it required, or even their tiny home, a trailer with no air conditioning. Once, after Frank's model airplane flew away from him, Susan spent the next day searching the area for miles, knowing how disappointed he was to have lost it. She didn't find it, but Borman was touched that she didn't want him to worry, even about little things. Soon, Susan was pregnant. A month before the baby was due in September 1951, Borman was transferred for the second time in 8 weeks, this time to Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas. He protested, arguing that the move was too much for his 8 months pregnant wife. A captain reminded him, in various shades of blue, that there was a war going on in Korea. Borman gathered blankets and a pillow and turned the bench seat in the back of the Oldsmobile into a bed, tucked in his pregnant wife, and drove to Las Vegas. On October 4, 1951, Susan gave birth to a baby boy, Frederick. On the same day, Borman flew two missions, no time off for a brand new father, such was the urgency of wartime training. The work of a fighter pilot was exceedingly dangerous. Six men died over one weekend, all at Borman's base. At home, Susan never allowed her husband to see how these accidents made her shake. New orders sent Borman to the Philippines, closer to the war in Korea, which was just what a fighting man wanted. Still just 21 years old, Susan sold the Oldsmobile for the price of a one-way plane ticket and, with baby on lap, made her way to Manila. Another son, Edwin, was born in a Quonset hut at Clark Field in July 1953. A few months later, Borman's tour in the Philippines ended, and so had the Korean War. The battle he'd signed up to fight had faded away. Borman spent the next several years logging hours in fighter jets, learning to drop atomic bombs, waiting for his chance to defend America. Always he posted the highest marks, blending rare piloting skills with a fighting instinct and a mission-first tunnel vision. Wherever he went, he considered Susan his secret weapon, a partner, mother, and best friend who arranged their lives so that his only worries were in cockpits. Not all of it came naturally to Susan. Every boom in the sky, every siren on the base had to be answered by reminding herself, it's not going to happen to Frank. He's different. Frank's a better pilot than they are. Frank will always be okay. After leaving the commissary one day at Moody Air Force Base in Georgia, Susan witnessed a mid-air collision between two jets. She knew Frank was flying at that time. Both airplanes were two-seaters, but only three parachutes opened in the sky. Frantic, she ran toward the billowing black smoke and tried to climb a fence to reach the field, but she was intercepted by a GI who ordered her to go home. Susan raced back to her neighborhood and banged on the door of Frank's boss. The man's wife let her in. "What do I do?" Susan asked. "What you do is wait," the woman said. And Susan did, for 2.5 hours, until Frank landed and called her. He reacted to news of the fatality as he always did, by thinking, "That dumb son of a bitch killed himself. It'll never happen to me because I'm better." It was a defense mechanism shared by many fighter pilots, and Susan bought into it too, at least for now. In 1956, Borman was ordered to earn a graduate degree in aeronautical engineering in order to become an instructor at West Point. He enrolled at Caltech in Pasadena, where he kept up with some of the best students in the world. By 1957, he had his master's degree and was teaching thermodynamics and fluid mechanics at West Point. He loved being back at the place that had shaped him. If anything, Susan loved it more. Her boys were playing Little League baseball and learning to swim. She decorated the family's apartment, and Frank was home most nights. For the first time since they'd married, it seemed a stable existence, and one that might last. A few months later, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik. Borman couldn't imagine a bigger blow to national pride, or a clearer indication that America was losing the Cold War. Already a staunch anti-communist, Borman now believed the United States to be facing an existential threat. From that point forward, his thinking changed. If he could do anything to be part of the fight America needed to bring against the Soviet Union, he would do it. Even if the United States needed him to drop an atomic bomb, he wouldn't have hesitated for a second. He didn't want to kill anyone, let alone innocent civilians, but his faith that his country would always act as a force for good in the world trumped all. In 1960, Borman applied to and was accepted by the Air Force's exclusive Experimental Flight Test Pilot School at Edwards Air Force Base in California. It was in the skies, he thought, that the fight against the Soviets would be decided. Technology would determine how high and how fast. He began training in a Lockheed F-104 starfighter, flying at 1,600 miles per hour, more than twice the speed of sound. Much of what he did at Edwards was experimental and untested, making it dangerous in ways one couldn't train for, and in ways that he never discussed with Susan. Borman graduated first in his class academically, and second in flying, and won the award for best overall student at Edwards. He would have been first in flying, but for a momentary failure to raise a landing gear, a slip-up that would bother him for years. He then signed on to establish a new program at Edwards, the Aerospace Research Pilot Graduate Course, designed to prepare future astronauts to fly. He and four other top pilot engineers would create a curriculum, making sure it best positioned a man for selection by NASA. It did not escape his notice that as an instructor, NASA might consider him to be among the best candidates of them all. In March 1961, Borman came to a crossroads. NASA was looking to bring on a second group of astronauts and asked top Navy and Air Force pilots to apply. If he had any interest in going into space, now was the time to strike. Borman didn't thrill to the idea of riding on rockets or exploring the cosmos or even stepping on the moon. The instant celebrity conferred on astronauts seemed a distraction to him, and yet only NASA could deliver him onto a new battlefield, where technology and futuristic flying machines could help determine whether democracy or communism prevailed. With the Cold War growing hotter every day, he could think of no more important place to do his part than on the frontier of space. He talked to Susan. He told her he had a chance to help America and to make history, but it would require undertaking a new life and unknown risks. Susan answered, as she always had. They were a team, and she would support him. A short time later, he submitted his application to NASA, joining more than 200 other highly qualified hopefuls. He endured exams, physical and psychological, and several rounds of cuts as NASA trimmed its list of finalists to about 80, then to 32. Finally, in the fall of 1962, 18 months after he first put his name in the hat, Borman became one of the agency's 9 new astronauts, selected from America's best to go where mankind had only dreamed of going. NASA introduced its second group of astronauts to the public at the University of Houston on September 17, 1962. Soon to be dubbed the New 9 by the press, they included James Lovell and Neil Armstrong. All 9 had been test pilots and had studied aeronautical engineering. All were married and had children. From the moment he stood beside these men, Borman could tell he was among a rare group, talented and competitive beyond any he'd met. The new astronauts became instant celebrities. As with the original 7, each received a contract with Life magazine and Field Enterprises that paid him $16,000 a year for exclusive access to his and his family's personal stories. For her part, Susan would be obliged to speak at luncheons and urge young mothers to buy World Book encyclopedias published by Field Enterprises for their families. NASA assigned each new astronaut to a specialty. Borman's was boosters, the rockets that lifted spacecraft off Earth and into orbit and beyond. His focus would be on a crucial aspect, the crew safety and escape systems. Borman and his colleagues would spend hundreds of hours in classrooms, visiting contractors and on field trips, learning everything from astronomy to meteorology to flight mechanics to computers to spacecraft construction. If America was going to reach the moon by President Kennedy's deadline, now just 7 years away, the astronauts had to learn in gulps, not sips. That applied to public relations, too. Meet and greets became commonplace. Black tie functions, the norm. Everyone in America, it seemed, wanted a piece of the astronauts. Once, Borman and Susan shared a limousine with a celebrity on their way to a gala sponsored by a wealthy Texas oil man. "I'm Tony Randall," the man said. "So nice to meet you," Borman said. "I really enjoyed your song, I Left My Heart in San Francisco." The actor did not appreciate being mistaken for the singer Tony Bennett. Borman did not appreciate the arrogance in Randall's indignation. "To hell with him," Borman whispered to Susan. As Borman settled in at NASA, it became clear to peers and management that he was a different breed, even among these unique men. He did not dabble in reflection, showed no patience for shades of gray. Mission came first, always. And if he sensed you were unqualified for a job, or worse, a bullshitter, he got your ass out of the way. He seemed unconcerned with NASA politics, blew smoke up no one's posterior, superiors included, and would not say or do anything he did not believe in. Some astronauts considered him arrogant or hard-headed, but all respected him, and few would have disagreed with Borman's own assessment that he was among the best of the astronaut corps. Like most astronauts, Borman was conservative politically, yet he voted for Democrat Lyndon Johnson for president in 1964 because Borman believed strongly in racial justice and civil rights. He was affected by Johnson's famous Daisy television commercial, aired during the campaign against Barry Goldwater, that juxtaposed a little girl against the mushroom cloud made by a nuclear bomb. The image disturbed Borman, yet he was ready, at a moment's notice, to drop the same kind of bomb on the Soviet Union, if that's what America deemed necessary. In 1964, Deke Slayton, the man in charge of crew assignments, teamed Borman with Jim Lovell to be primary crew for Gemini 7. The mission was planned as a 14-day Earth orbital flight, the longest space mission ever attempted, intended primarily to test human endurance in space and to conduct a cascade of medical experiments. During training, Borman and Lovell averaged more than 20 days a month away from home. When Borman got time off, he spent it with his family at home in Houston, taking Susan and his sons hunting and fishing. Susan doubted she could bring herself to shoot a deer, but after Frank and the boys bought her a rifle, she had no trouble taking the shot. Frank never figured out whether she missed on purpose. To him, it meant everything that she tried. To learn to water ski, he and Susan checked out a book from the library, then took turns driving the boat, pages flapping in the wind. He loved how fast Susan took to it, even as he struggled. His boys delighted in how their father, a master of the skies, could barely swim. To make it to his son's junior high football games, Borman pushed NASA's T-38 jets to their operational limits on Fridays after work, then ran to the hamburger stand Susan operated at the games, ready with his order in hand. On Saturday, December 4th, 1965, Susan and her two sons arrived at the VIP area at Cape Kennedy for the launch of Gemini 7. At 2:30 p.m., the Titan II rocket fired. As it rose in a column of white smoke and orange flame, Susan held on to her boys but looked away. Photographers captured the image, a good mother, a woman overwhelmed. 6 minutes later, Gemini 7 was in orbit around Earth. Susan and her sons boarded a bus to the airport to go home. Out the window, Frederick and Edwin searched the sky for a glimpse of their dad's rocket ship. Despite being confined to a cabin no larger than the front half of a Volkswagen Beetle, the longer Borman and Lovell flew, the more they liked each other. Every day, over and over, they sang "He'll Have to Go," a 1959 country ballad by Jim Reeves. "Put your sweet lips a little closer to the phone," they crooned. "Let's pretend that we're together, all alone." After 11 days in space, Borman and Lovell received visitors. Approaching like a white star, Gemini 6, which had just launched from Cape Kennedy, closed to within 1 foot of Gemini 7, proving that two ships could rendezvous in space, a necessary maneuver for flying a lunar landing mission in which astronauts would use a lunar module to shuttle between an orbiting spacecraft and the moon. Lovell burst out laughing when the Gemini 6 crew, Wally Schirra and Tom Stafford, flashed a sign to Borman, "Beat Army." Schirra, Stafford, and Lovell were Navy, and as a West Point man, Borman had no choice but to take it. By the time Borman and Lovell splashed down in the Western Atlantic, they had set records for duration of flight, more than 330 hours, or 13.75 days, distance traveled, more than 5 million miles, and number of orbits, 206. More important, they'd helped America take a major step toward the moon by proving man could endure long stretches in space. The 2 weeks they'd spent was the maximum duration it was believed a lunar mission would require. Borman was immediately made a full colonel, the youngest in the Air Force, at age 37. A few weeks after splashdown, Susan wrote an article that was published in newspapers around the country. People had noticed how frightened she'd been during launch and the flight, and not everyone appreciated it, including some at NASA. "These past weeks, I had worn my feelings on my sleeve," she wrote. Some said they were pleased to see an astronaut's wife willing to admit she was scared. Others, including some people in the space program, were critical because I failed to maintain the traditional stiff upper lip. "For heaven's sake, wipe your tears. You're ruining my morning coffee," one woman wrote. At one time, such criticism would have cut me deeply, but I have come to realize you can't be all things to all people, so I decided not to pretend and not to try to hide my feelings. I decided to be myself. Soon after Gemini 7's return, Borman received a telegram from West Point offering him a permanent professorship of mechanics. Susan loved the idea of returning to an idyllic life at West Point, but Borman said he couldn't do it. His heart was in flying, and he had a Cold War to help win. He would stay with NASA. A year later, the tragic Apollo 1 fire occurred. Susan made it her mission to comfort and support her friend, Pat White, the wife of one of the fallen astronauts. She visited the new widow every day, listening to her, holding her, and crying with her, trying to be strong as Pat kept repeating, "Who am I, Susan? Who am I? I've lost everything. It's all gone." At night, when Susan got home, she began to drink a bit, if only to quiet her nerves. In the past, Susan had dealt with fatalities among Frank's colleagues the same way he did, by assuming it would never happen to him. But Ed White was different. He was a near-perfect physical specimen, even stronger than Frank, yet even he had been unable to get the spacecraft's hatch open during the fire. Frank told her that Charles Atlas himself couldn't have moved the hatch, but it was more than that to Susan. Ed White had been a West Point graduate, a devoted husband and father, and a committed patriot. He didn't screw around with muscle cars or other women, which was to say, he was just like Frank. After 18 months investigating the fire, testifying before Congress, and working on the Apollo Command Module redesign, Borman was offered the chance to be the commander of Apollo 8, man's first lunar mission. The flight was full of risks and unknowns, but it was where Borman had been pointing since he first soloed a single-engine airplane over the skies of Tucson. He hadn't known how that flight would end either, but his instructor, Miss Bobby, had believed he could go anywhere. Now, when he told Deke Slayton he would go to the moon, he believed it, too. Chapter 6. Just 4 months. Astronauts scheduled to fly to the moon in just 4 months should have been training in NASA's Command Module Simulator, a ground-based model of the real thing. But, like most everything else connected to Apollo 8's new mission, it wasn't yet ready. Borman, Lovell, and Anders settled on what their responsibilities would be for the mission, each according to his own experience and to his role on the flight. Borman would focus on the boosters and abort systems, the trajectory, and piloting the spacecraft. As commander, he would also be in charge during the flight, overseeing the crew and assuming responsibility for mission success. Lovell would be the command module pilot, in charge of navigation. He would use the spacecraft's sextant, an optical instrument similar to those used on board sailing ships through the centuries, to measure angles between the sun, moon, and stars. Primary navigation would be done by computers and mission control personnel, but Lovell needed to navigate, too, in case of technical failure on the ground or a complete loss of communications. He would also map lunar landmarks and scout candidate areas for future landings. To learn the new guidance system, Lovell needed to spend time at MIT's Draper Lab, where he would practice sighting stars by focusing on the bright white light coming from atop a tall insurance building across the Charles River. Anders would be the systems engineer, responsible for understanding how the highly complex spacecraft functioned. He had to master every switch, dial, lever, and gauge in the command module, where the astronauts would live for 6 days. He needed to have a thorough understanding of the service module attached to its base, which housed the systems for electric power and life support, and propellants essential to making the journey. There were thousands of intricate parts and connections and operations, and Anders had to make sure they all worked. He would also be in charge of photography, chronicling the flight on still and movie film. To this end, Anders fought to bring a 250mm Zeiss sonar telephoto lens aboard. It was giant and heavy, but he had a feeling he'd need it. Anders had come to change his thinking about Apollo 8's new mission in the weeks since it had been conceived. He'd been disappointed when told his crew would go to the moon but wouldn't land there, given that it required him to give up his training as a lunar module pilot and become a command module specialist instead. On future missions, he'd probably be the guy who stayed behind in the orbiting spacecraft while his two crewmates walked on the moon. For a man who dreamed of collecting rocks from the lunar surface, that packed a wallop. But then he'd gotten to thinking. Flying on Apollo 8 meant that he, Lovell, and Borman would be the first human beings ever to leave Earth, and the first to arrive at the moon, and the first to see its far side. That was like being another Christopher Columbus. And what more could a curious man hope for than that? The astronauts weren't the only ones under the gun. Director of Flight Operations Chris Kraft and others began constructing a detailed flight plan, one that accounted for every hour of the 6-day journey. Even a wasted minute would be unacceptable, given the risk and opportunity. Kraft also began his own study of the spacecraft and flight support systems. Kraft wanted to understand the ship better than the astronauts did, so if anything faltered, he'd already have been through the emergency and worked out every possible solution in his mind. Nearly everyone involved in Apollo 8 had to coordinate with other departments, linking arms across NASA and industry to form a massive, cohesive whole. The agency and private industry needed to work together to prepare the command module, mate the spacecraft to the Saturn V rocket, and move it all to the Cape. Mission Control in Houston had to coordinate with the Cape to work out countdowns and launch windows, with the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville to determine the rocket's maneuvers and trajectories, and with the contractors and universities that would help make complex calculations. It also had to make sure every part and every system was built to specification and on schedule. Computers and software had to be built and updated, electrical wiring diagrammed and tested, and the tracking stations around the world which would relay voice and data between the flying spacecraft and mission control in Houston, brought up to speed. All of this, and so much else, had to be finished in just over 100 days. All while NASA prepared for the launch of Apollo 7 in just 1 month. If that flight wasn't near perfect, Apollo 8 wouldn't go. On Friday evening, August 23rd, the astronauts went home for a rare weekend off. Many of their neighbors were like them, astronauts or NASA employees. Conservative, politically, with front lawns and haircuts that were military short. Boys still said, yes, sir, when speaking to adults. Girls still wore dresses. When the network newscasts came on the black and white televisions that night, color was still a luxury for many, few in these neighborhoods recognized the country looking back at them. Thousands of anti-war protesters had descended on Chicago for the Democratic National Convention, which was scheduled to start in 3 days. Gathering in parks and on the streets downtown, these protesters, most of them under 30 years old, intended to make their demands for peace known to the Democrats and to the world. Rumors as to the protesters' intentions had circulated for weeks. Word had it that these long-haired young people planned to dump LSD into the water supply, stage nude-ins at Lake Michigan, turn over cars and toss Molotov cocktails, run off with delegates' daughters. A siege mentality took root in Chicago's elders. Except for one rally in Grant Park, Mayor Richard J. Daley refused to issue permits for the protesters to march, gather, or camp out in parks. To enforce Daley's peace, 12,000 Chicago police officers, armed with military gear, stood at the ready, backed by 6,000 members of the Illinois National Guard and 6,000 regular Army troops. To the astronauts, Chicago seemed a universe away. They lived military lives, rarely intersecting with the counterculture. Like most astronauts, Borman, Lovell, and Anders found the lifestyle and tactics of hippies in the anti-war movement unbecoming, even unpatriotic. But they didn't dismiss these young people. Each of them knew that the powder keg that looked ready to ignite in Chicago hadn't formed overnight. Tensions had been building since the start of the year, one that was shaping up to be among the worst in the nation's history. Already, 10,000 or more young Americans had been killed in Vietnam, and 1968 wasn't nearly over. Anti-war demonstrations had erupted around America. Racial tension had led to riots. Student protests had turned bloody. In a 9-week span between early April and early June, two of the country's most inspirational figures, Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy, had been assassinated. Swaths of the population no longer trusted government or authority or institutions. Even music seemed more political and angry than before. Now, all of the year's turmoil seemed to be coming to a head in Chicago. As the crew of Apollo 8 prepared to resume training after a weekend at home, 2,000 demonstrators massed in Chicago's Lincoln Park. Many had nowhere else to sleep, but the city's curfew required them to disperse at 11 p.m. When the hour struck, police outfitted in gas masks and helmets moved in, firing tear gas canisters into the remaining crowd, clubbing and kicking whomever they could reach. The convention opened the next day. Protesters marched on police headquarters, then redirected to Grant Park. At the convention, Daley promised, "As long as I'm mayor of this town, there will be law and order in Chicago." On television, 89 million Americans tuned in to see the direction the country might take. On August 28th, the Democratic Party voted against adopting an anti-war plank to its platform. The peace candidate, Eugene McCarthy, refused on principle to address the convention, and Vice President Hubert Humphrey secured the nomination. A crowd of 10,000 rallied in Grant Park. Tempers flared, and soon billy clubs and boots were flying. Rennie Davis, One of the organizers of the demonstrations was beaten unconscious. Thousands began to march to the site of the convention, but they were turned back by National Guardsmen, some brandishing automatic weapons and grenade launchers. That left the protesters outside the Conrad Hilton Hotel on Michigan Avenue, where they remained into the night. By the thousands, they shouted epithets and profanities at police, delegates, politicians, anyone in charge. And to many, it no longer sounded like free speech or the expression of opinion. It sounded like America had burst, and the bile that discharged flowed uphill on one of America's most exclusive streets, seeking higher and higher levels so that Humphrey would hear it in his 25th floor room and LBJ would hear it at his ranch in Texas. The police stood there taking the worst of it. In ordinary times, a person cursed at a Chicago cop at their peril. Yet peril seemed to be what the demonstrators wanted most. After 30 minutes, the police obliged them, smashing and clubbing and kicking and dragging anyone they could reach. Demonstrators, onlookers, journalists. And it didn't matter that the network television cameras were filming, or that people were yelling, "The whole world is watching," or that those in the streets weren't Viet Cong or Soviets, but the sons and daughters of fellow citizens. All that mattered for the next 18 minutes of brutality and mayhem was that something had fractured in America, and no one had any idea how to stop it. And after order was restored, there still seemed to be cries coming from the streets, even though there was no one left to make them. Among the millions who watched the unedited footage on television, there hardly seemed a soul among them, rich or poor, young or old, left or right, who didn't wonder if America could be put back together again. On Sunday, September 8th, the crew of Apollo 8 flew their T-38 jets from Houston to Cape Kennedy in Florida, checked into the Holiday Inn at Cocoa Beach, and prepared to die. Often. In the morning, they would start training in the Command Module Simulator, an Earth-based model of the Apollo spacecraft they would pilot in December. Housed in nondescript buildings at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston and at Cape Kennedy in Florida, the machines were highly accurate mock-ups of the real thing. Their cabins outfitted with every switch, lever, dial, gauge, light, alarm, circuit breaker, and readout the astronauts would use on the lunar journey. Everything worked. The simulator itself didn't move, but optics could be projected onto screens, navigational information displayed, sounds played over speakers, and lights flashed. The 700-plus manual controls functioned just as they would during an actual mission. An astronaut could spend years poring over diagrams and schematics, but he would never know a complex machine like the command module without spending time inside its landlocked twin. Any segment of a mission could be replicated, any situation reproduced, any scenario played out. The astronauts could fly the simulator just as they would the real spacecraft, working through segments of their lunar journey in real time. Any mistakes, and they'd know it. And they wouldn't be the only ones. Seated outside the simulator were a set of NASA employees who served as instructors. They were the ones who programmed scenarios into the simulator and who watched the astronauts' every move on their consoles, ready to make critiques and corrections. Leading the team of instructors was the simulation supervisor, or SimSup. One of his jobs was to teach the astronauts the correct sequences and procedures for every part of the flight, from liftoff to lunar orbit to splashdown. His other job was to kill them. Spaceflight was inherently complex and unpredictable. Crews were nearly certain to encounter problems with the rocket and spacecraft during their mission. To give them a fighting chance, the SimSup would unleash an arsenal of emergencies, failures, malfunctions, and conflicts into the simulation, forcing the crew to learn to survive, showing them the consequences of every wrong move. It would do no one any good to take it easy on them. Only by theoretically endangering the lives of the men inside the simulator could the SimSoup hope to save them during actual flight. In this way, the best SimSoups had a streak of the devil inside them. Flight controllers and others involved in the mission would also work with the SimSoup and instructors. Astronauts in the simulator at the Cape would be able to talk to controllers in Houston, to launch specialists in Florida, even to ground stations in Australia. The simulation was nearly as elaborate as the actual flight. The crew of Apollo 8 knew they had to be ready. Borman, Lovell, and Anders ate a pre-dawn breakfast together, joking about how close they'd have to sit in the simulator, threatening whoever dared show up without brushing his teeth. The sun was just rising when they arrived at the command module simulator at Cape Kennedy. It was Monday, September 9th, 1968, less than 15 weeks before Apollo 8's scheduled mission. Despite the early hour, the room was crowded with flight controllers and technicians, many of whom were in their 20s, some just out of college. At age 40, Borman and Lovell were nearly twice as old as some of the men gathered around the simulator. Even Anders, at 34, seemed an elder statesman here. As test and fighter pilots, the astronauts had flown cutting-edge machines, but even they needed time to process the sight of the Apollo simulator. Standing about 20 feet high, it was a hodgepodge of sharp-cornered modules that appeared jammed together by cubist painters, jazz musicians, and mad scientists. There seemed no front or back, or even up or down, just shapes. Hundreds of cables dangled from the contraption like dreadlocks, while two narrow staircases, one circular, the other straight, led inside, or at least somewhere. Bracketing the structure were consoles of computers, instruments, and monitors for the instructors. Fluorescent white light bathed the room. After a briefing, a technician directed the crew to the straight staircase, a steep incline of 14 carpeted steps with spaghetti-thin handrails that led to the simulator's hatch. For the most part, the astronauts would not need to wear their flight suits in the simulator, which was good news on this day since their flight suits still hadn't been made. Once inside the cabin, the crew lay back in their seats, also called couches, since they supported the men's bodies from head to toe. Anders on the right, Lovell in the center, Borman on the left. Anders stared at the panels of lights and indicators that were flickering to life, knowing it would take the entirety of his focus over the next 100 days to learn to ride the real thing out of this world. Borman looked at Lovell and Anders. He'd always been a sharp student of character, and as he sat there, he believed he had the best crew ever assembled by NASA. The closing of the hatch echoed inside the cabin. "All right," Borman said to his crewmates. "Let's learn how to go to the moon." A week later, on September 14th, the Soviet Union launched an unmanned spacecraft toward the moon. Both the Americans and Soviets had sent probes to the moon in the past, but this one, called Zond 5, was different, because the Soviets intended to get it back. No spacecraft had ever come near the moon and returned safely to Earth. If the Soviets could pull it off, it would represent a major leap forward, and a clear signal they intended to send men to the moon in early December, their best launch window and 2 weeks before Apollo 8's scheduled liftoff. Streaking out of Earth's atmosphere, Zond 5 carried tortoises, wine flies, mealworms, and other living organisms. Strapped into the pilot's seat was a 5'7", 154-pound mannequin, its sensors absorbing radiation data. With modifications, the same ship could carry 2 cosmonauts. The day after Zond launched, NASA Chief James Webb announced his resignation, effective October 7th. Earlier in the year, upon learning that President Johnson wouldn't seek re-election, Webb had decided to step down. Until then, Thomas Paine would continue as deputy administrator, then assumed the reins in Webb's place. Word of Webb's resignation surprised the NASA brass. Most considered him a giant, as responsible as any person, Kennedy included, for making the American space program world-class. But there was a silver lining. Webb had never been fully on board with the plan to send Apollo 8 to the moon in December. Payne always had been. A day later, good news arrived for Apollo 8. The Saturn V rocket had passed its design certification review, meaning the fixes and modifications made by von Braun and his engineers after the booster's troubled test flight on Apollo 6 in April had been judged to be effective. Even the violent pogo problem seemed to have been tamed. Pending a few final checkouts, the rocket looked ready to launch three astronauts to the moon. The crew of Apollo 8 spent much of the next day, September 18th, in the command module simulator in Florida. They were joined, as they often would be during training, by their backup crew, Neil Armstrong, Edwin Buzz Aldrin, and Fred Hayes. By Slayton's assignment scheme, backup crews became primary crews three flights later. That meant Armstrong, Aldrin, and Hayes would be prime crew for Apollo 11. Late that night, while the astronauts slept, the famed British astronomer Sir Bernard Lovell, no relation to Jim Lovell, reported that a massive radio telescope in England had tracked a Soviet spacecraft, Zond 5, as it passed within 1,000 miles of the moon. Further, it appeared that the ship was now making a return journey to Earth. Lovell concluded the Soviets intended to recover the craft. "Once they have achieved this," he said, "we can anticipate that they will put a man in one." The next night, observers picked up a different kind of signal being broadcast from Zond 5. This time, they heard a Russian voice. No one believed a cosmonaut to be aboard Zond 5, but the man calling out the ship's instrument readings was as real as the spacecraft itself. His voice, and others heard later, belonged to cosmonauts and were being transmitted live from the Soviet Union to Zond 5, then beamed back to Earth by the spacecraft, all by way of practice for the real thing. Soviet intentions were clear. A manned lunar mission was coming very soon. But Zond 5 wasn't home yet. On September 21st, the spacecraft collided with Earth's atmosphere at a speed of 24,600 miles per hour. In seconds, deceleration forces reached between 12 and 18 Gs, a punishing but survivable load for properly trained humans. 1 G is equal to the force of gravity at Earth's surface. 2 Gs is equal to twice the force of gravity at Earth's surface, and so on. For 3 minutes, Zond 5 raked through increasing resistance until it plummeted through a darkened sky toward the Indian Ocean. At an altitude of about 20,000 feet, its single parachute deployed, leaving the craft, still glowing from the heat generated by re-entry, in a final ride to the water. Still alive inside the capsule were the tortoises, just 10% lighter for their near week in space. Several fly eggs had hatched. It had been a rough return, but the bottom line was unmistakable. Living creatures had survived a round trip to the moon. In England, Sir Bernard Lovell told reporters that Russia had regained the lead in the race to send men to the moon, and that Zond 5 makes it highly probable that a Russian will get a close-up look at the moon quite a long time before an American does. At NASA, the preparations for Apollo 8 grew even more intense. While the astronauts trained for 12 or more hours a day, the spacecraft was moved to the Vehicle Assembly Building at Cape Kennedy, where it was mated to the Saturn V rocket. Voices of opposition to the Apollo 8 mission began to ring out. In a September 24th editorial, the Washington Post warned, "Our program ought to move at its own pace. If that pace is sufficiently rapid to bring American astronauts to the moon first, fine. If it is not, so be it. The Russians will deserve the honor and praise they will win if their men make the first landing. In space exploration, it is more important to do things right than to do them first. In a letter to Webb, astronaut Buzz Aldrin's father, himself a former Air Force colonel and an aviation pioneer, wrote, "I do not favor a manned flight of Saturn V until the changes being made have been proven. What is the value of risking lives at this stage? You really need less yes men in the space program." On October 9th, a sky-high bay opened at the Vehicle Assembly Building, revealing the gargantuan Saturn V, white with black patches and streamlined to a narrow point at the top. An elegant monster 15 stories taller and 5 times heavier than the Saturn 1B the crew of Apollo 7 were scheduled to ride into Earth orbit. Only a rocket with that kind of size and power could lift a payload as heavy as an Apollo spacecraft bound for the moon, although most of the rocket would fall away in the first few minutes of flight, and the rest of it a few hours later. For several minutes, the Saturn V stood and gleamed in the Florida sun. And then, it started to move. The rocket stood atop NASA's Crawler Transporter, the world's most powerful tractor. Powered by 2 16-cylinder engines with a combined 5,500 horsepower and 16 locomotive traction motors, the Crawler Transporter was the largest self-powered land vehicle in the world. By itself, it weighed 6 million pounds, and it could move payloads in excess of 12 million pounds. The 131-foot-long vehicle rode on 8 tank-like tracks, 2 on each corner, each pair the size of a Greyhound bus, and could deliver its payload to within inches of its target destination. Its top deck was the size of a Major League Baseball infield. Carrying the Saturn V to the launch pad, it would cruise at 1 mile per hour. Engines grinding, the tractor moved the Saturn V and its tower out of the white Vehicle Assembly Building and into daylight. A slender 34-foot-tall launch escape system sat atop the rocket and seemed to scrape the nearly full moon hanging in the sky. Soon, the structure was moving down the road toward Pad 39A, a journey of about 3.5 miles, where the spacecraft would undergo exhaustive testing, verifications, and countdown rehearsals until the December launch. A man in white shirt sleeves and a black tie operated the Crawler Transporter from inside a control cab, while several engineers wearing hard hats rode atop various platforms on the tractor. Like the red fire engine that drove beside them in case of emergency, these men appeared to be toys in the shadow of these machines. As the Apollo 8 hardware made its reptilian crawl, it might have been easy to forget that in just 2 days, Apollo 7 would launch on an 11-day Earth orbit mission designed to test the Apollo spacecraft and systems. That flight, historic in its own right, and NASA's first since the fatal fire, had to be near perfect for Apollo 8 to get its green light for December. Apollo 7 sat atop its Saturn 1B rocket on October 11, 1968, a 20-knot easterly wind blowing against the spacecraft and into Commander Wally Schirra's instinct. Mission rules prohibited launching into winds that could push a spacecraft back on shore during an abort. The ground could be a deadly hard landing spot compared to the ocean. But that was just the kind of wind whistling at Cape Kennedy during the countdown. Lying on his back alongside crewmates Don Isley and Walt Cunningham, Schirra grew furious that NASA seemed determined to fly despite the hazard he perceived. He argued against launching until about an hour before liftoff, when he realized it was too late to call things off. Just after 11 a.m., with the wind still howling, Apollo 7 launched successfully. All went well until the second day, when Schirra came down with a head cold. a condition made even more uncomfortable given that noses don't run in zero gravity. To make matters worse, the crew struggled with their biomedical equipment, strained to see out their windows, and were forced to pump wastewater manually from the spacecraft. When Mission Control asked about the live television broadcast scheduled for that day, Shira made it clear where he stood. "You've added two burns to this flight schedule, and you've added a urine water dump, and we have a new vehicle up here, and I can tell you at this point TV will be delayed without any further discussion until after the rendezvous." It got worse. Though the spacecraft was functioning beautifully, the astronauts' attitudes were breaking down. On day 7, Cunningham said to controllers, "I'd just like to go on record here as saying that people that dream up procedures like this after you lift off have somehow or another been dropping the ball for the last 3 years. It looks kind of Mickey Mouse." On day 8, Shira said, "I wish you would find out the idiot's name who thought up this test. I want to talk to him personally when I get back down." In Houston, Kraft and Slayton were seething. Not only were Shira and his crew nearly insubordinate, they were doing it for the public to hear. At a press briefing, a reporter said, "I've covered 16 flights, and I don't recall ever finding a bunch of people up there growling the way these guys are. Now, you're either doing a bad job down here, or they're a bunch of malcontents. Which is it?" Apollo 7 splashed down 11 days after liftoff. Every mission objective had been achieved, and more. The spacecraft had worked beautifully. The SPS engine, so critical to a lunar journey, had performed well. By virtually every measure, the flight had been nearly perfect, and it would open the door to Apollo 8's flight to the moon. Many attributed the negative behavior by the crew of Apollo 7 to the constant discomfort from their head colds. Others wondered if Shira had been terrified by the Apollo 1 fire. The commander of that mission, Gus Grissom, had been Shira's next-door neighbor. Shira had been Grissom's backup pilot for the flight. Long after the fire, Shira had told people, "We all spent a year wearing black armbands for 3 very good men. I'll be damned if anybody's going to spend the next year wearing one for me." Despite the technical brilliance of the mission, Kraft wouldn't abide insubordination, even if it was born of legitimate fear. He determined that none of Apollo 7's crew would ever fly again for NASA. He felt differently about the crew of Apollo 8. Borman, Lovell, and Anders were consummate professionals, as rock steady as they came. He was certainly grateful for Lovell. Kraft had been ringside for Gemini 7, the grueling 14-day mission during which Lovell remained unflappable, even during problems that might have threatened the flight's survival. Equally important, Lovell was as likable and optimistic a fellow as there was in the astronaut corps. And on man's first journey away from his world, there could never be too much of that. Chapter 7. Jim Lovell. Every Saturday when he was 5 years old, James Arthur Lovell Jr. went to the movies, always to see a Western. Sometimes he went with his father, but the best times were when he went alone. Walking untethered through Philadelphia as a little boy, he was free to discover new neighborhoods, invent new routes, pass strange faces, navigate a giant world by himself. Born in 1928, Jim grew up in the teeth of the Depression, but his father had work and the family didn't want for much. All of that changed around the time Jim reached 5th grade. His parents separated, and not long after, his father died in an automobile accident. Needing to support herself and her young son, Blanche Lovell moved to be near her brother in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and took a job as a secretary for modest wages. By 1940, she and Jim were living in a tiny one-room apartment, their kitchen jammed into a closet, using a single toilet shared by everyone who lived on the floor. In 1940, An American kid could hardly walk into a drugstore without seeing a new kind of flying machine streaking across magazine covers. The rocket. Jim couldn't get enough of the fins and flames and faraway planets painted in full color by the magazine's visionary artists, or the stories of what these machines could do. Rockets didn't just